89.1 KANW FM and HD1 Albuquerque. KIDS Grants. KNLK Santa Rosa. KGGA Gallup. 89.1 KANW now presents Who Guards the Guardians? A special New Mexico Town Hall live from the Albuquerque Journal Center Auditorium.
Good evening. I'm Kent Walls, Senior Editor of the Albuquerque Journal, and I'd like to welcome all of you tonight to this Town Hall Forum on Guardianship in New Mexico. It's an important issue, and it's one that touches many of our lives and many of our loved ones. And it's touched the nerve in the community, as evidenced by the fact we had to turn away many people who wanted to be here in person tonight, and we appreciate all of you who have come out for this discussion, which will be 2 hours of a frank but civil dialogue on this issue. We have an outstanding panel tonight for the forum, which is sponsored by the Journal, KANW-FM, and the City of Albuquerque's Department of Senior Affairs. I'm going to start by briefly introducing the panelists before I turn this over to Tom Trowbridge, my colleague from KANW. From left to right, and the numbers are not a rating, they are the microphone so they can be cued, investigative journalist Diane Diamond, retired Chief District Judge Ted Baca of the 2nd Judicial District, Susan Bennett, founder of the New Mexico Guardian Association, District Judge Alan Malott, Emily Darnell Nunez, Mayor Richard Berry, Kelly Smoot Garrett of the American Association Against Guardian Abuse, Senator Jerry Tisipino has not joined us yet, we hope he does, former Representative Conrad James, who has been involved in legislation on these issues, Gail McConnell, New Mexico Guardian Association board member, Alexis Lotero, New Mexico Securities Division, and Georgia Armijo Brasher. This is an outstanding group, and we very much appreciate you taking the time to be here tonight. Tom?
Thank you, Kent, and thanks to all assembled here tonight, those listening and those who will be watching, thanks to Michelle and Ray from CNH Productions. This public forum is a new partnership between the Albuquerque Journal and KANW, another example of the devotion both outfits have towards serving our community. The Journal extending its reach with public affairs programming covering issues of importance facing our people, our city, our state, and beyond. These journalistic efforts go far beyond the headline, the soundbite, or as in radio we call it, the actuality. You know those little blips of tape you hear from newsmakers? Actual voices, we call them actualities. We're exploring these issues, though, and in the process, seeking and capturing the perspectives from as many sources and angles as we can. The topic and panel assembled here tonight will serve that end. As for 89.1 KANW, well, you don't get this kind of programming anywhere else on the dial in New Mexico. We run fine radio programs from all the big names, but we also provide local news, weather, and traffic, Dateline New Mexico, New Mexico Close Up, among our New Mexico news offerings. I'm proud to be affiliated with KANW New Mexico Public Radio. I'm honored to be here in this role tonight. And I want to throw it now to Diane Diamond, who's really her investigative reporting has led us to this forum tonight. Diane.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you, Kent Walls. The job of a journalist is not to report that the trains have run on time. And the job of an investigative journalist begins when they come into contact with information that they think the public needs to know. That's what brought me to the issue of elder guardianship, the system that is in place in America today. I became acquainted with it because of a case in Pennsylvania. I wrote one of my syndicated columns, which runs in the Albuquerque Journal, on that issue. And I was deluged with letters from all across the country, from people saying, "Me too. It's happened in my family." But what struck me was the number of letters I got from New Mexico. This is my home state. I couldn't believe it. So I set aside the research I was doing, national research for a book, and I concentrated on this state. I've been asked to summarize my findings here, so here goes. First of all, I'd like to say that there are different kinds of guardianships. There are guardianships for children, for mentally impaired people, for physically impaired people, and for senior citizens. And within the senior citizens' guardianship, my focus, there are two kinds. One is paid for by tax dollars for the indigent, Medicare and the like, and the other is a guardianship system set up for people of means whose families, for some reason, have come to court asking a judge to decide what to do with mom or dad. Now, those who work in the industry were hard to get to talk to me, frankly, but as I did my research, about 10 months worth, it became a sort of tale of two cities. People within the industry who did speak to me, caretaker companies, lawyers, conservators, guardians, and the like, told me that everything was fine with the system as it is. They said that the judges are in charge. The judges only appoint people of high moral character and quality, that the judges make sure there are audits done on a regular basis. Well, we found the report that a conservator has to put in to talk about how the money for an elder person, a ward of the court, has been spent. It's 2 pages long. If it's not filed, there's a $5 fine per day. It may be a $5 fine. So, again, back to the people in the industry. They told me, and this is a direct quote from a guardian lawyer, everything is fine except when the families don't do what we say, when they fight us. And I heard over and over again from people in the industry that there were abusive and greedy family members who just could not wait to get their hands on their parents' money. No doubt that happens. I'm positive that it happens. There are mentally and physically abusive children, adult children. But I did find it a little bit rich that a lawyer, say a guardian lawyer making $200 an hour, would wrinkle their nose at the fact that an adult child was concerned about how their inheritance was being spent. After all, their parents saved their money to give to their child, not to court appointees. So the other side of the tale of two cities was the families. And I talked to many people who started the petition process. They were fraught with guilt. Their attorneys, they said, never sat them down and told them what would happen once the system got into effect. They did not know that their parent would be stripped of their civil rights. They did not know that a judge could find that their bickering, the bickering that brought them to court, meant they were, quote, dysfunctional and therefore ineligible to service mom or dad, and that a stranger would come in. They didn't know that they could be banned from seeing their parent if they argued with a court appointee. Then there were the other relatives who were blindsided that one of their own would go to court behind their backs. There was confusion and frustration and anger on the behalf of these people. And anger because a judge could institute a process that was so permanent and all-encompassing. There's no gray area there. They described to me heart-wrenching moments where their parent, usually suffering from some sort of dementia, would look at them with tears in their eyes and say, "Who are these strangers in my house? Why can't I go to my granddaughter's wedding? Please fix this." And of course, there is no fix, because once the guardianship takes hold, there's no turning back. I ask every single family member if they complained to the judge, and they said, "Yes, indeed, we did." But they felt their complaints fell on deaf ears, because as one son of a ward said to me, "Why would a judge admit that they had appointed someone who was of low moral character or unscrupulous or someone who would actually threaten families with arrest or violence?" So my tale of two cities became a tale of catch-22 for these families. Now, yeah, I talked to more families than I did industry people, but it wasn't for lack of trying. My time is just about up, so I just want to say, I want to quote one daughter of a ward in closing. She told me, "You know, the system just wears you down because they want you to give up." Mary Darnell did not give up. She is in the audience tonight, and this is her mother. Those were my findings. In a nutshell, those were my findings. The rest is in this pamphlet. So I leave it up to you, the audience, the radio listeners, and my readers to decide if this is this kind of system you want your tax dollars to support. That is not up to me. That is up to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Diamond. Our next speaker will be retired Chief District Judge Ted Baca, who, when Judge Baca was still on the court, decided they needed to take a look at the guardian system here in the 2nd Judicial District and decided that there were some avenues that they should follow to address things. Before I turn this over to Judge Baca, I do want to mention that there will be some questions that will be addressed later. They've been pre-submitted by some by members of the audience, others by readers and listeners, and we'll have a chance for the panelists to speak to some of those questions. But Judge Baca?
Good afternoon, evening. The way the system works actually is it is controlled by statutes that were passed by the legislature. And the courts don't go out and look for these cases to come into court. These cases are brought into court. What happens is usually a relative who is staying with somebody determines that one of their relatives, their father, their mother, one of their brothers, one of their uncles or aunts, is not acting well anymore. And they become concerned, they go see a doctor. A doctor says this person has dementia, Alzheimer's, or some maybe physical illness that renders them unable to take care of their activities of daily living. They can't manage their medicines and they can't manage their assets. And the relatives can't take over making those decisions because they have no authority to do that. So they have to file a petition and bring it to court. Now, what goes in that petition is governed by statute. So they have to name the alleged incapacitated person. They have to appoint or propose for appointment a guardian ad litem who is a lawyer who is supposed to represent the alleged incapacitated person, a visitor who is qualified, or supposed to be qualified, to go and do an investigation to see if the person they are proposing to be the guardian or the conservator is qualified for that position. And then they also have to bring in a letter or, if possible, but it never happens, an actual doctor to testify as to the condition of the person. Usually, we just get letters from a doctor describing their evaluations, not usually just one, but over a period of time, and concluding that the person can't take care of themselves anymore and they need the appointment of somebody who can. So this all happens. Judges sign an order appointing the guardian ad litem and the visitor, because without that appointment, and it's the petitioner's lawyers who bring these names to us. Although after a number of years, we start becoming aware of who they are and how they proceed in these cases. Anyway, so they get appointed, they go do their investigation, they all come to court. The incapacitated person has to come to court too. It's a requirement, unless there is some agreement that it would just be too unnerving or more harmful than helpful for that person to be there. And we usually ask the guardian ad litem, who represents that person, what their feeling is. But most of the time they come, and usually a lot of the family comes too, if it's a family thing. So judges are told by a visitor, I've evaluated, I've done my investigation, this person is qualified to be a guardian or a conservator. That's what a judge hears. The guardian ad litem has investigated everything and says, my client requires the appointment of a guardian or a conservator, and I concur that an appointment is justified. And then we have a letter from a doctor that tells us the person does in fact suffer from some disabling condition. So we appoint them, and what happens is they all turn around and they walk out the door, and we never see them again. So we never know what happens after that. So in the court, we found out through over time, we had heard stories. Some of the lawyers who do this for a living came to us and said, you know, there's problems out there. There are problems. You know, what can we do? And we said, well, let's find out what those problems are. So we gathered a bunch of lawyers, by maybe 20 or 30 lawyers, volunteered their time. They probably spent 20 or 30 hours each. They investigated up to 50, maybe 60 cases. I'm not sure, because it was way back in 2007. And after a few months of this investigation, they wrote reports. They brought the reports back to the court. And what it determined was 25 to 30 to 35% of the cases were not performing very well. And in fact, a lot of them were performing very, very badly. So the court knew that guardianships and conservatorships needed to be monitored. They needed to be guarded, as this pamphlet says, who guards the guardians. We knew that. We went to the legislature to try to get their attention, to have them appropriate some money so we could do a larger study so that we could really convince them that it was a statewide problem. We never could get the money. We couldn't get their attention. They didn't seem to be concerned one bit about it. So that's, my time is up. I could go on forever with how frustrating that was. And here we are 10 years later. Ms. Diamond has done this article. I would say, though, that while 25, 30, or 35% of the cases were not performing very well, the other ones were. So, I mean, the train wreck is what gets the news, but all the other good ones don't. So the system isn't entirely in collapse, but it does need some work.
Thank you, Your Honor. Next up, we have Susan Bennett, the founder of NMGA, explaining the system and its benefits. Susan.
Hi. I appreciate being here. My first point is that the needs and the protection of the vulnerable, at-risk person are the most important concerns in guardianship. If family members are a threat to that protection, they are not appointed as guardian. Second, we do need a broader system to train, certify, and oversee guardians and conservators. But to portray all professionals in this field as bad people, as I believe the journal articles have done, does not present the truth and does a disservice to the elders in our community. In 2004, I co-founded the New Mexico Guardianship Association as an affiliate of the National Association. It was created to provide education and support to New Mexico guardians and conservators and to locally adapt the national standards and ethics. I have handouts later with the websites for those and a couple other organizations. I'm retired from over 20 years of social work and paralegal work in guardianship law and medical ethics. I was involved with hundreds of guardianship cases as case manager, supervisor, court visitor, hospital paralegal, or in ethics consults. So I know guardianship from the inside. The cases I dealt with were mostly adults with mental illness, disabilities, dementia, or a combination. I worked with many dedicated and compassionate guardians, conservators, attorneys, judges, psychologists, neuropsychologists, and doctors, including psychiatrists and neurologists. Declaring someone incapacitated was not taken lightly by these professionals. An elder may be able to converse, but no longer be able to manage their affairs due to the impairment of the brain's area of executive functioning. I believe Ms. Diamond's journal articles presented a slanted and incomplete picture. They did not even touch the surface of how toxic some family members can be to their parents. This is often the reason that non-family guardians are appointed. Under guardianship, family can visit the parent unless they have harmful effects. I saw many such cases. In my view, these articles were long editorials, not truly balanced investigative journalism. Ms. Diamond did not mention the many hours of free or minimal fee work done by guardians, court visitors, and attorneys to protect our citizens with few resources. Her broad brush approach casts a shadow over the integrity of many good and tireless people who do the very challenging daily work of protecting our elders. Much of the focus was on family members who seem mostly worried about their inheritance and less about the care of the aging parent. We are not entitled to inheritance until after the parents are deceased. The articles relied heavily on complaints from family members. How do we know they told the whole truth? Most families with aging parents do not end up in court. If they do, family members have legal priority and are often appointed guardian. In my experience, if family members are not appointed, it is because they have taken money or property, have neglected the parent's needs, they are emotionally or physically abusive to the parent, siblings are fighting, so the parent's care falls through the cracks. The parent may be too difficult to handle and the family just can't do it. Or family members may have serious mental or emotional issues and the parent needs protection from them. If family members want to heal in these difficult situations, they first need to take responsibility if they have committed egregious acts against their parent. Any new oversight programs or legislation need to be very carefully crafted, keeping in mind the reason guardianship statutes were developed in the first place, to protect the most vulnerable of our citizens, sometimes from their families. The public is entitled to balanced reporting and trustworthy journalism. I wish the interests of our elders had been better served by these articles. Thank you.
Thank you. And Diane, you'll get a chance later, as everyone else will, to weigh in here. We're going next to Judge Alan Millott, who is also known to journal readers and I assume listeners for his extraordinarily well-done legal column that was published in the journal for years. I told him before the panel tonight that we really missed it. And as you go into this, Judge, I was curious. We have the conservator report and account. There's nothing in here that specifically mentions fees, what conservators charge for these services. I found that curious, but I thought perhaps it's a point you could address as well. Thank you.
I'll be happy to address that, but I need to preliminarily let the audience know that as an active judge, we have sort of a unique position in these forums because I cannot and I'm not going to comment on pending cases. I'm not going to comment on what other judges do. And I can only talk to you as a judge of the Second Judicial District, so I cannot talk about how systems run in other parts of the state. And unlike my column, I have to keep a certain amount of my personal feelings personal. So please understand that as we proceed. In our situation in the Second Judicial District, and in fact, more broadly, people need to understand that a cohesive approach to guardianships is only about 30 years old across the United States. And New Mexico adopted what we now use as a uniform code around the country only as recently as 1989. There are thousands. At last count, we had about 6,000 open guardianship files in the Second Judicial District alone, some of which go back to, one of mine went back to 1947. I only go back to 1953 myself. And yet we have active files that go back as far as anyone could possibly remember. And our gentleman with the 1947 guardianship is still alive and well at the VA. I was interested to find. But what needs to be understood is it's a relatively new system, and it was not until we adopted in 2011 the electronic filing system that we were able to get a continuous coding for these cases across the state so that we could pull up information. Otherwise, literally, you have to go down into a dark vault and start pulling out files. In addition to, so there are 10 civil judges in Bernalillo County. And as I told you, there are about 6,000 old guardianships, so you can do the math. In addition to having to be responsible for those cases, we each have about 1,400 active files to handle. That's almost three times the recommended caseload across the country. So our problem, as Judge Baca pointed out, is resources. I've been a lawyer in New Mexico for 40 years. Every year, I've been on the bench since 2009. Every year since 1979 when I got sworn in as a lawyer, We play the same ridiculous game of keep away between the courts, the legislature, and the executive branch. It is nonsense, and it is counterproductive to every level of judicial function in this state. And this is no exception. Turning to guardianship specifically, we get about 400 guardianship cases filed in the courts each year. About 200 of them, about half of them, go to the Second Judicial District Court. That's a pretty small number. Last year, civil cases amounted to almost 10,000 new filings. This is a few hundred of them. Of the cases we get, as Judge Baca pointed out, the vast majority of them are not contested. And I want to be very clear about this, because this is a sort of a common misstatement that the courts take jurisdiction. We do not. People come and tell us they need us to do something. We don't go out looking for these cases. They are brought to us by people who are otherwise unable, as is kind of common amongst litigation in general, people who are unable, unwilling, or whatever, to work things out on their own. I was 56 years old when I went on the bench, and I would have thought myself past naivete when I found out that people really steal from their parents. And so we have to be able to be fully, A, funded, and be directed by the legislator, by the community telling the legislature what they want, in developing a system that is better. Our system does not have wholesale problems, at least not in the second. I have had probably 3 or 4 hearings in 8 years that dealt with real dysfunction amongst the guardians and the families. I have had cases where families come in and they have a generation, sometimes more, of dysfunction. I cannot fix that. No judge can fix that. That has to come from other resources. And I see my time is up, so I'll bring up more as we discuss this further. Thank you.
And thank you, Your Honor. Next up, we have Emily Darnell Nunez, who will give us a family member's perspective on the guardianship system in New Mexico. Emily.
All right. Good evening, everyone. I am the daughter of Blair Darnell and Casey Darnell. And I have been listening to this, and I, you know, 5 minutes, what can I say? There's so many ways that I could communicate, but I think I'm going to try by just saying I'm a professional in New Mexico. I've worked here in New Mexico. Our whole family's from here, and we love New Mexico. My parents were New Mexico true, if you want to believe that or understand that. We were lucky enough to grow up on the west side of Albuquerque at a time when there was nothing on the west side of Albuquerque. You had to get to our house on a ditch road from the Bosque. We drove the ditch from Alameda to our house, which my dad bought 5 acres, and my parents planned their life there for their family and their community. They chose to create a horse community. They love horses. Both of them did. My mom loved horses, and my dad was a horseman, and they grew up there, and everybody, all the professionals in town who had kids who wanted to learn to ride came and rode at our house. We never had a meal without other people at our house. Every foreign exchange student that ever came to Albuquerque and didn't get along was with a dysfunctional family, didn't get along with their family, would end up with us. Every foreigner, lots of foreigners at our house. We had Brazilians, Japanese, all wanting to learn to ride from my mom and dad. And my mom was a special character in that she would allow people to clean the stalls and water the horses and feed the horses. And then she would always take them on an educational trip. So she'd take them to the Bandolier, or she'd take them for a picnic. And I'm telling you this story because she instilled in her children these values. And her children have been exposed to this system that we can't even imagine has happened to us. And I personally think that it's it's just not okay what's happened. I can't believe what's happened to our family and how it's happened, and I can't believe that everybody out there isn't a part of some sort of a dysfunctional family. I'd like to see a family that's not in conflict, especially around transitions. I work in early childhood. I've done a lot of work in New Mexico around early childhood. I've sat on task forces. I've helped create systems that have worked for our young children. We develop pre-K. We've worked to create better systems for our children in the state, and I am resourced up. When this happened, I told my mom, you know what, mother, that's just one side of the story, my naivete. We'll go to court and tell our side of the story, and it'll all be okay, because we were raised to appreciate judges and to appreciate the system, and we thought, we'll go to court and tell our side of the story. We never have told our side of the story. And if you don't like what's written in this story, it's because it's probably the truth. And there is an ugly side to guardianship. And I'm not going to say that maybe some families do need it, but our state needs to fix it. And not inviting families who I appreciate, the families that are here, the families that are listening, who this has happened to. We have bonded together. We've had to sit with each other and cry with each other and hold each other's hands about the horrific things that have happened to our loved ones that we feel could have been done better by their parents or by their children. Just to say a few things, we are not about bashing caregivers or bashing people who have been a part of the system, because this system is filled with lack of transparency and fear. And the fear goes all the way up and down. I have not been a vocal one. You'll see mine was the least quoted in the article. My voice was the least heard in the article because I was with my mom to the end because I shut up. I was afraid to speak. I was afraid to have a voice, and I'm a very resourced up person. And I wanted to be able to see my mom every day, so I didn't say anything. I tried to get along with everybody, no matter what they did to me or what they did to my mom. And I'm reacting out of what I saw happening to my mom. I just want to say, I talked to 100 attorneys, 4 judges, secretaries of different departments in the state who referred me to other people that I talked to. I talked to so many people about this issue and what was going on and how to work with it. I would love to talk to this whole panel at some time and beyond to continue to not let this happen to other families. I believe New Mexico can do better for guardianship, and I believe that we need to really focus on this in the upcoming election. So everybody out there, if you think you want to do something, how about talking to our future governor about making guardianship workable in our state that values families? New Mexico should be valuing all our families. We do value the cycle of life in the state. We look at families all the way around in other cultures. And my parents were two people who valued their community, who contributed. My mom contributed so much to this community for free, on her own time, with her own money, with her own beliefs that that's what you do with your community. And Mayor Berry, you would be fortunate to have known her and had her as a part of your community. She worked with the school district, she worked with the university, she worked with the museum, she worked with children. She did a lot for this community. And so I appreciate that everybody's here willing to listen to our stories about her, and if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to contribute.
Thank you, Emily. Next, we'll go to Mayor Richard Berry, and we'd like the mayor to talk about his interest in this issue and some of his concerns and what the city and what your leadership might be able to bring to this issue.
Sure. First of all, thank you for the opportunity. I don't come here tonight as a judge or an expert in this category per se, but I come as a man who has 600,000 brothers and sisters and moms and dads and aunts and uncles. I serve my community, and I get to see my community every day. And I get to see their struggles in many, many areas, and I get to see their triumphs. I get to see the good days, and I get to see the really, really bad days. People think sometimes when you call the mayor's office, it's to yell about something or to complain. But honestly, if you asked my constituent services folks who are literally 30 feet from my office, Many times when the phone rings, it is because people are at the end of their rope. It's a veteran who doesn't know how to get their veterans' benefits, and that's not what we do at the city, but we can help connect. And that's kind of why I'm here tonight, is to offer some opportunities for us as a community and tell you that as your mayor, we're here to listen. I'm here to listen as much as I am here to talk tonight, and I'm already starting to gain a much, much better understanding from the articles, from the comments tonight, and we'll continue this discussion. And at the end of my few minutes tonight, we'll give you a couple of phone numbers to talk about. But I also want to bring a different perspective to this, and that's as a former state legislator, and I know Conrad James is going to speak, so I don't want to speak for him or any other legislator, but let me give you my experience. I was on the Appropriations Committee, and Kiki Saavedra was my chairman. And when we talk about the legislature and we talk about resources and we talk about how we're going to solve this issue, one of the things that you need to remember, and I'm not here as an apologist for the legislature, but when you're on the Appropriations Committee, you have one group after another all day come in. You've got an enormous amount of need, and you've got a limited amount of resources. When you take K through 12 and higher ed and corrections out of your state budget, you've got maybe 13% left for everything else. So as a legislator, when you're talking to your legislators, just remember that one day they'll have you as a group talking to them, and then they will have a room full of parents whose children have autism, and then they will have a group of family members whose loved ones need DD waivers, and then they will have a group of veterans and a group of teachers and a group of retirees and a group of farmers and a group of ranchers, and everybody has a compelling need. It's not a matter of that, but we're going to have to figure out ways to tackle these tough issues together. And I would just recommend, as we go to our legislators, we talk in terms of understanding what they have to deal with as well. This does matter, and we can do better, and we have to do better as a community. I think Judge hit on a good point earlier, Judge Malott, when he said data. We are in a new age of data, which means we're in a new age of transparency, which we are in a new age, if we can figure it out, of giving our judges better information faster to make decisions. We can also help with family members through data. So I think that is one of the things that is not incredibly expensive, but we can figure out opportunities to share that. We also have great opportunities with volunteerism. We haven't heard anybody talk about ombudsman yet, but my father-in-law is 82 years old, and he is an ombudsman in this exact area. And so he goes out and he visits nursing homes on a regular basis, and I think Karen is in the room tonight, the state coordinator for that. You've got a group of volunteers out there in your community and across the state of New Mexico who care deeply about this. Don't forget about them. Don't forget that they need resources, and that's value added for not a whole lot of money. So let's get them the resources that they need as well. When it comes to oversight, from my time in the legislature, I learned that sometimes there's arrogance in policy, and that arrogance is that we sometimes believe that the more we legislate, the better we're going to do. And I just have found over the years that if there's somebody that is intent on doing something wrong or against someone's best interest, sometimes it's not the words in the statute that are going to make the difference. But it is oversight that will make the difference. And that oversight can come from a number of things. It can come from government agencies. It can come from family members. It can come from volunteers. But also, if you just make the process more transparent, then it's that old adage of keep the honest people honest. That will help a great deal if we can simply shed light where it needs to be shed so that people have a less propensity. And that doesn't mean just one more form to fill out, but sometimes just adding that component of transparency can make a big difference. So here's what, with all of that said, what are we going to do as a city? George Armijo Brasher is your last speaker tonight. She's my director of senior affairs. She and her staff do a wonderful job caring for seniors in our community. We have one of the best senior support systems of any city in America. So leverage us. Coach us. Help us understand what you need, knowing that we aren't the judges, we are not the state, we are not the people that run that system. But we have a phone number, and it's 764-6400. And we are going to start setting up a few task forces after tonight. We're going to sit down with our community. We're going to try to weed through some of the difficulties, and we're going to try to find those areas where we can make a difference so that we can then be a collector of that data, be a connector of families with services, and then we can also inform policy at the state level. We can work with judges to let them know what we're hearing. Let us be your eyes and your ears, and we can help at least be your voice in what is a complex and sometimes difficult issue. But just know that we are here, and we would like you to use us.
Thank you, Mayor Berry. And that phone number again, please? It was at
764-6400. And if you call tomorrow, it's going to be one of those things where I announce it tonight, so work with us. If we get 600 calls tomorrow, we're going to have to deal with it. But the fact is, we are part of our community. We're here to help. Use us as best we can. We will step up, roll up our sleeves, and work with our community.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Our next member of the panel is Kelly Smoot Garrett, Executive Vice President of Americans Against Abusive Probate Guardianship. Kelly, if you would tell us a little bit about yourself and your organization. What do you all do?
Thanks. We're a 501c3 organization founded in 2013 by Dr. Sam Sugar in Aventura, Florida. This was in response to Dr. Sugar's mother-in-law being put under guardianship, and it was highly abused, and he lost quite a bit of money along with his family. And he has been silenced by the court from speaking about his case. He has a gag order against him. I am here as a representative for the victims of New Mexico that have reached out to AAPG, and there are numerous of them. Right now, we count about 20 families that have active guardianship cases or have had guardianship cases, some of which go back to the year 2000, and they represent a collective $50 million. $50 million has been misappropriated by the courts and their appointees in these abused guardianship cases. And I'm going to take a little different tack than I was going to, because I feel I must respond to Judge Baca and Judge Malott, because as they have described the system, it's the way it's supposed to work. Absolutely, there are state statutes governing guardianship. Of course there are. And of course judges have oversight over their guardians and their appointees. And of course, the record keeping is not perfect. However, that's not the way the system works. The court appointees break the law all the time, and the judges look the other way. And I have to say, these two judges are not on the list of ones that have been that egregious in looking the other way. But I will point to the Darnell family and the ruination of their property, which was a $5.1 million piece of property, 17 acres on the Rio Grande River, when it was brought under guardianship by an attorney, because it's attorneys that take these cases to you. It's not the families that come into you. It's the attorneys that start this process. And they start it because it's very lucrative to them. They can make tons of money because they're sitting there. We at AAPG have estimated, and I've passed out a brochure, and if you didn't get a copy, come up and I'll give you one right here. But we estimate there's in New Mexico $13 million annually lost to abusive guardianships that are not conducted by law, as Judge Malott and Judge Baca have indicated they should be. And you can look on the back of the program, and there are two attorney statutes. One attorney rule of conduct. And the first one is a duty of loyalty, that a trustee must act to the beneficiaries of the trust. And the second one is that attorneys holding positions of trust like trustee, conservatorship, and guardian are held to a higher standard. And I'm going to assume that judges are held to an even higher standard. But then you go down and you look and you see that Judge Brickhouse approved an order of sale in the Darnell property, and they approved the sale of Lot 2B to Jay Rimby for $1.545 million on the 25th of June in 2013. The next thing you know, the conservator and trustee appointed by the court, Daryl Millett, has created a realtor's addendum, and he's going to sell both lots 2A and 2B, which is not in the order. The order specifically says Jay Rimby will be given an option to purchase lot 2A upon Blair Donnell's passing. The second addendum shows it's basically a worthless piece of paper because it only has Daryl Millett's signature on it. And it just says, this represents the verbal agreement that Judge Beatrice Brickhouse on Friday, February 27, 2013, satisfies the requirement for court approval of the sale. It's not signed by anybody but Daryl Millett. It has no, there is no judge record. There is no order from Judge Brickhouse on record to sell Mrs. Dardanelle's property, reducing it from $5.1 million when attorney Gregory McKenzie brought it in to guardianize Mrs. Dardanelle because $5.1 million of property was going to be lost at any moment. And Daryl Millett reduced that to $964,000. That's an 80% reduction in value. That is shocking, and that has all been done against the law, and this is what sequestration is covering up. We must immediately have the transparency that Mayor Berry has called for, and the very first thing that has to happen is unseal every single court record of guardianship, because without that, we don't know how these judges are approving or if they're even doing their job in approving these cases. And this is costing everybody in New Mexico gobs of money. You've just had to give $600,000 to your criminal courts because you are about to run out of money for criminal trials. Well, one of the ways your money is being spent is on these never-ending civil trials that go on and on and on. The Dardanelle's case is still not closed. Why? Because Mrs. Dardanelle's attorney refuses to release the will. An attorney is simply saying, I'm not going to give you a copy of the will. That is rank probate fraud. But because this is all sequestered, nobody knows anything about it. So I urge you to read this brochure. We call on New Mexico law enforcement to do what Nevada did just on March 8th. They sent down, they impaneled grand juries, and they sent down 270 indictments against three guardians and one attorney. And they have changed that rule that only the clients go to jail, not the attorneys. We're going to make sure some of these law-breaking attorneys and the judges, if they found to be colluding with the attorneys to steal our property, are put to jail. Thank you.
It's a very, very passionate issue. Thank you. We're going to switch now, and we're going to do a couple of audit questions that have been submitted in advance. And the first one is from Laura. Is Laura here tonight in the audience? Laura's not here, but she submitted a question or several questions. And these questions, we condensed and did some editing. We took some names out so that what we're trying to address is an issue and a principle here rather than a specific matter. So here's Laura's question. When my mother was ordered into guardianship conservatorship, an attorney presented the judge with an order of appointment of guardian and conservator with plenary powers. I was the petitioner, but I was not provided with the order until after the ruling was made. The order did not contain a reporting of monthly charges and balances to be sent to my mother's children. Is it legal or ethical for an attorney to provide orders in advance to some involved parties and not others? Where would I go to complain? Does the court have a formal complaint process? And I thought we would ask Susan to respond first, and then we would go to Kelly. Susan?
I'm not sure why you're asking me to respond to that. That sounds like a question.
Well, it's a question about what is the procedure that's acceptable for a court-appointed guardian. In this case, the guardian ad litem presented orders, allegedly, to certain parties and not others, and the order did not contain information on costs.
I would have to quote the statute on what's required, and I don't know it offhand, so someone else could better answer that question. I'm sorry.
Would any of the industry people like to take that one on? Or Gail, would you?
Sure. So the order actually has to be submitted to the guardian and the conservator for approval so they know what they are going to be charged with.
They submit the order, correct, to the court?
No, usually it can come in from a number of directions. The drafting attorney does have to circulate it among the other counsel for approval, and then the guardian and the conservator both have to have reviewed it so they know, you know, what their job is. In this situation, I don't know why it was handled that way. The court is appointed. The court is approached with a proposed order. Sometimes the judge will make a decision that is not that has it wasn't contemplated. You didn't know which way the judge was going to go, and so then the judge will charge an attorney in the room with drafting the order.
Is it typical in the order to include something like a fee schedule of things that are going to be charged by the guardian and by the conservator?
No. And what is done and what
Judge Millott?
The best practice is that the court requires the bills to be submitted before they're approved. That is done in some of the cases. I don't do it in every case because it doesn't get brought to me that there's any kind of a dispute. And I'm again going to make a very firm point. Neither the judges nor lawyers bring these cases. They are brought by people who want the court to take action. If they hire a lawyer and the lawyer is unscrupulous, that's a different story. And much was made about this story out of Nevada, and I want to point out to anyone who read the article or wants to read it, because I got a copy of it here, the focal point was that the courts do not have the resources to monitor these people. And that is still the problem in every state, but especially in New Mexico. Cannot talk about the Darnell case, because A, I don't know about it, and B, as I said earlier, I can't comment on pending cases. But the responsibility of each judge is to look at these cases and determine what, at least on the surface, looks like the best interests of the person who's supposedly either ill, infirm, or otherwise incapacitated. My practice is, it's a 60-day appointment, and I want you back in here, and let's talk about it. And let me make sure of what's going on. I don't know if everyone else does that. But that is a good practice. I want to address one other thing is on this issue of sequestration. That's a matter of statute. I happen to personally agree that the only things that should be sequestered is medical and financial information. And that's from the public. Family members should get everything.
Let me just briefly go back to the fee schedule. You say the court approves the bill, the bills.
We review bills on an ad hoc
after they are submitted. But that's isn't the order appointing the guardian and the conservator essentially saying you're hired to go do this job?
Yes.
Okay.
But at that point
you don't say for what? For $200 an hour, for $500 an hour, for $9 an hour. You just wait and at some point ad hoc review whatever bills they submit.
Because the court is not empowered, and I don't think the public wants the court to be empowered to set fees. That's not our job.
So then when you review them ad hoc, how do you decide if they're appropriate or not?
I didn't interrupt you, ma'am, and I didn't make comments.
Yes, please
about
don't
what
please
you
don't
saying.
Please don't interrupt the speaker. So how do you decide what fees are appropriate on that in that system?
If you do the same thing over and over, you tend to see what people are charging. If I have a problem with what I see is being charged, I can A, simply not allow it to be paid, and I've done that. I can appoint an independent attorney to review the fees and help me understand whether there was something special or whatever. I do agree that just signing off is not a discharge of what we're supposed to be doing, but people have to bring it to us. We don't go looking for this. People in the community want the courts to suddenly become surrogates. That's not what we're here to do. Many states have surrogate courts, and that might be a good thing, but not here. It's not the way the system works. If the community wants to change the system and set up a surrogacy or an advocacy branch, that'd be great. Because it would take care of a lot of these problems for us.
Well, thank you. Since you see these cases on a recurring basis, what are the typical fee schedules for guardians and conservators, since that seems to be an issue that comes up?
I would say probably running between $200 and $300 an hour.
Very good. Thank you. Kelly, did you wish to respond to Laura's question?
Yes, just a little bit of everything. The question as it originally was posed was about how the system works and whether or not it was supposed to work in the way it did or something different. And it evidently didn't work in the way it was supposed to do, and I just want to make the comment that unfortunately, from the victims and the family situation, tends to be the majority of cases. The system doesn't work the way it's slated to. And similarly, when Judge Millott and Judge Baca also talk about sequestration, and they talk about that it is, you are correct, absolutely, of course, it's mandated by state statute that was passed by the legislature. And that state statute is, part of I don't have the number here. Oh, yes, I do. It's, no, I don't have the state statute. It's part of the probate code, and it is clearly designed to sequester information except for items: docket entries, date of proceedings, appointment and termination. Three is duration of guardianship and conservatorship, and the name of other information necessary to identify the alleged incapacitated person. That is written in. That information must be made available to the public. Well, right now in the Second Judicial District, since my mother died in 2013, when it was still under presiding Judge Baca, and I believe that now it's Shannon Bacon, those four comments cannot be seen in any guardianship cases. And there are New Mexico rules of attorney conduct and judicial conduct that have been passed by the state Supreme Court that those are actually the rules that sequester the attorneys and the judges from releasing that information. But those rules also state these four items: docket entries, date of proceeding, appointment and termination, duration of the guardianship and conservatorship, and the name of other information necessary to identify the alleged incapacitated person are violated daily by the Second Judicial District right now today. Because if you look on any daily docket, you cannot find the name of the person being put under guardianship. People under the daily docket, the only way the public can find this out, and this is clearly in the statutes and in the Supreme Court promulgated rules of conduct, that these four items have to be available, and they are not. They are not available in the Second Judicial District Court, which means the Second Judicial District Court is violating its own state statutes and rules of conduct daily.
And it's my understanding from the Chief Judge that we have begun to address that. That was a problem. It was incorrectly done when we set up the electronic system. That is not sequestered information. And as I say, I think that is amongst a number of changes that could be made regarding sequestration in general.
Yes, on both these points, it has been Journal Reporter's experience, in addition to Ms. Diamond, that court clerks are not aware of the statutory language that you just read. And sometimes, if you actually show them the statute, sometimes they will relent and show you the required information. But there is a general belief in the court system that these files are entirely sequestered and that information, in fact, is not public. So that is correct. I'm glad to hear that you're addressing that, Judge. Susan?
That was a problem. It is a problem. A
couple of things briefly on sequestration. I believe it was developed for the privacy of the elder person with dementia. The risk of not having sequestration, I think, is a lot of these cases are very messy and nasty, and the family dirty laundry will be public, and it can be very hard on everyone. The other question regarding fees, and can you predict what the fees will be up front? As guardian, I know it was very, I could say what my hourly fee would be or what the hourly fee of the agency I worked for would be. But you never know how much time you're going to put in on a case, because when you become guardian, it's almost like adopting a child. You go to the ER in the middle of the night. My longest trip was 12 hours with a person with advanced dementia who had broken her leg completely through while she was out with family, and she kept forgetting why she was there. And so the fees are unpredictable. You never know what's coming up. If the family members try to spend a lot of time talking to the guardian, the fees have to go up. No one's going to do this work for free. It's very difficult work, and that is what doesn't come out. And I understand difficulties with families. They go through all kinds of things. But many times, just as in the cases of child abuse, sometimes families have to be kept apart.
Thank you.
We'll move on to our next question. It comes from Evelyn. Is Evelyn here tonight? No, Evelyn. Oh, there. Okay, thank you, Evelyn. It's also about sequestration. The question, doesn't the extensive sequestration of court records really only protect the players and not the protected person? We'll direct this question first to Judge Millett again, and also Diane Diamond. Judge Millett, please.
Well, I think it can. I think, as I've said, the only real areas that are, in my opinion, necessary or even appropriate for sequestration are medical and financial details Otherwise, I don't see why any case should be kept out of the public's eye except in individual circumstances. There are particular reasons. But the broad brush that has been used and somewhat too broadly used, I don't think serves anybody's purpose. And I think it can cover up the players or misconduct. It doesn't always, but it can. I mean, anything in the dark is in the dark.
Great. And Diane.
Thank you, Tom. I had an attorney involved in the system who was not supposed to talk to me, but did, said, quote, sequestration, Evelyn, only protects bad people so they can do bad things. That was his opinion. I believe sequestration does protect the protected person. I agree with Susan. She might be surprised at that, but I do. I think it does protect the elderly person. But we already have HIPAA laws, federal laws that say you may not release medical information. I don't see why Colleen, the other investigative reporter at the Journal, found out this thing that Kelly mentioned. They're supposed to release the docket of what went on in a case. I don't know why that isn't done. That just tells you I've had 7 different hearings and on these dates, and that helps a reporter like me figure out what happened. It also goes to the veracity of the family telling you what happened. We had a hearing on this date. I can look at the docket and go, yeah, there was a hearing on that date. So, yes, I think sequestration does protect the players. It also protects the elderly person. But I agree with Judge Malott 1,000%. And with the mayor. Transparency, let the sun shine in on this system. You're paying for this system. And if I can ask, how many people in this room, and I will translate for the radio audience, how many people in this room were or are currently in the Guardian system or have a loved one in the Guardian system? Okay, that's a lot of you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I can't count them all. Would you agree that it could be open? Your mother, your father, your Aunt Tilly's case, whoever it is, would you agree that it could be open? There's a lady right here in Aqua in the front.
And the elderly person has dementia.
Wait, just one moment, and we'll get a quick microphone to you.
When the elderly person has dementia and their case comes up for guardianship, they're not offended. They don't know that their life is being put out there. And if their kids are as miserable as these people say they are, then their lives do need to be exposed. But the elderly person is not harmed by having the fact that they do have dementia and this is in court. How can they be harmed?
Right.
That's what dementia is.
Well, let's understand that not every guardianship involves dementia, and sequestration applies to everything. And there's a difference between the two. That's an important difference.